The Lisa Wexler Show podcast is brought to you by Winston Prep School for Kids with Learning Disabilities. Visit winstonprep.edu. Also brought to you by Onboard Services. For your staffing and engineering needs, go to onboardusa.com.
Attorney, advocate, author, public speaker, The Lisa Wexler Show, WICC 600. Flip that switch and turn on your brain. Here is Lisa Wexler.
We have a lot to talk about today. Before we get to a bunch of local crime stories, I just want to let you know that the blackouts in California are also putting the cell phone service at risk. And in fact, they're cutting a lot of cell phone service as a result. The recent power shutoffs, which are approaching 3 million people, which are have been done voluntarily to potentially, you know, to diminish the possibility of catastrophic fires, have also cut power to many cell phone towers, blocking the main communication source for many in harm's way. And just think about the last time that you can recall, truthfully, being away from your cell phone for any appreciable period of time. I dare you. I ask you. How long is it that you've ever been away from your cell device? Now, with the exception of my mother, who is at this point the only person I know who doesn't carry a cell phone, my mom still is the only one. I think that most people, frankly, forgot how to fend for themselves without one. And my son is on my mind because he's in Southern California, wending his way up to Northern California, laughing at me and poo-pooing me and saying, "Ma, what do I don't need to worry about a flashlight." I said to him the other day, just put a flashlight and batteries in your car. Just in case you happen upon a blackout wherever you are. And he did LOL, I've got my phone, meaning his phone is a flashlight. Well, his phone is a flashlight if his phone is working. His phone isn't working, it's not a flashlight. 203-333-9422. And the other thing I want to say is that the last couple of fires, they now believe were actually started by the wind pushing down one of the PG&E transistor electric poles up there that then caught on fire. And this is my pitch for underground connectivity with wires. You know, we here in Connecticut, one of the reasons why we're in so much trouble whenever we have a nor'easter or whenever we have a storm is because the wind knocks down the trees and the trees knock down the wires and then the wires are dangerous and then we don't have power. But if all of the wires were underground, then we wouldn't have to worry so much. We'd clean up the tree limbs and we'd move on our way and people wouldn't lose power. And I remember, and it was many, many years ago now. Admittedly. But I was in a room with the chair of, at that time, Northeastern Utilities. They weren't Eversource yet. And they were talking about how they were going to be spending their money. And I raised my hand in an audience full of people and I said, "Why aren't you doing some capital improvements over time burying the power lines? If you started today and you did 1% a season or 5% a year or whatever, eventually we would have a lot of the state underground." You know, and his first thing was, "Well, you know, with new developments, we try and do that." I said, "Yeah, but what about the existing? Most of Connecticut is not new developments. We're already here." And he said they didn't have the money for it. And I thought that was the most short-sighted, stupid remark. So I feel for the people in California, and I feel for everybody who's affected by these weather events. But the truth is that we know what we could do to reduce or lessen the possibility of having these massive fires and power outages. And one of the first things we need to do is bury our power lines. That is a way in which we need to allocate our financial resources. 203-333-9422. And by the way, I saw a movie last night on Netflix that a few people told me to see. It's called Laundromat. Did you see it? It's with Meryl Streep. And I thought to myself, what is Meryl Streep doing on a movie that just premiered on Netflix? But apparently it had a very short open and close in regular theaters before it came to Netflix. It's a peculiar movie. And it's a movie about the moving around of money and shell games and wealth and hiding stuff. It doesn't explain it as well as it could or as well as it should, but it's intriguing nonetheless. And I urge you to see it. It's called Laundromat, and it's about money laundering, and it's about how rich people evade taxing authorities. But the most chilling impact of the movie is what it has to say about the United States of America. And one of the basic messages of the movie is that we have states like Delaware and Nevada that are tax havens within the United States that perfectly legally help big companies evade millions and billions of dollars in taxation that they would otherwise have to pay. And that money would be going to burying our power lines. The money from the useful real money that companies ought to be paying in their fair share of taxes, if they were not legally evading or avoiding, I shouldn't say evading. Evading is a crime, avoiding isn't a crime. So I'll use the word avoiding. If they weren't legally avoiding the taxes that they were otherwise paying, our communities would have much better infrastructure because our local municipalities would be able to afford it. Just talking about a fair share. 203-333-9422. Halloween. Halloween is coming up this week. I want to know from you. Call me at 203-333-9422. How many of you are dressing up your animals? I have a good friend who just sent me an article that said, according to News 12, shoppers will spend more than $12 million on costumes for their pets. And in fact, this good friend dropped off a costume for Shayna. She wants to know if it's going to fit. Now, I am not somebody who dresses my dog. This is a cultural difference. I have some really good friends from Costa Rica, and they love to dress up their animals, which are typically chihuahuas, but not always. They love to dress up their animals. They just get a real kick out of it. I guess people spend a lot of money, generally speaking, on pet clothing. But I, putting myself into the, you know, into the personage of a dog, who really is a person, but you know what I mean, I say to myself, I wouldn't want to wear clothes if I had a fur coat on all day long. Like, what do I want to wear clothes for? It seems weird to me. But I just want to know if you're somebody who dresses up your animal. Would you like to know what America is anticipating spending based on history? We're anticipating spending on costumes alone over $3.2 billion for Halloween. For candy, we're spending over $25 a person. Okay, who's in it for the Kit Kats and Reese's Pieces? Not Reese's Pieces, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. Who's in it for the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup? The Reese's Pieces are a poor imitation. The Reese's Peanut Butter Cups and the Kit Kats. Can we raise our hands now? Can we raise our hands and say that Halloween is the one time where we don't have, as usual, a guilt binge? In other words, we get a guilt-free binge once a year on Halloween. Adults, I'm talking about. Forget about the kids. I'm talking about the adults. Guilt-free binges, anyone? Decorations, we spent $2.7 billion, over $26 a person on decorations for Halloween. And even on greeting cards, we spent almost $4 a person in America. Have you ever sent a Halloween greeting card to somebody? $390 million are going to be spent on Halloween greeting cards for Halloween, with a total expenditure for Halloween alone of $8.8 billion or close to $87 a person. Are you spending that much on Halloween? I'm trying to think. You know, Halloween is one of these things that goes through phases, right? If you have little kids, sure, you're getting them costumes. I never made my kids costumes. Who are we kidding? I bought them costumes, and I had a great time doing so. I really did. And I even saved one of the costumes from Joanna. It was the Cinderella thing that we got at Disneyland years ago. It's still in the closet. It's just, you know, I had to keep it. And but I never did greeting cards. Definitely did my share of candy. You like Halloween? Is it one of your favorite holidays? Some people really get into it. 14 minutes after 11 o'clock, 203-333-9422. Shall we talk about trick-or-treating? Do you want to talk about trick-or-treating? The other day, I had a guest on, and I really gave him a hard time from Pet Pantry because I have a hard time with parents. I have a hard time with helicopter parents altogether. Let me just start from that. That's the big idea. I have a hard time with helicopter parents, hovering parents. And Halloween, when I was growing up, was a holiday that we owned as kids. Like, we felt like it was our holiday. You had to be old enough to go trick-or-treating when I was a kid. Little ones didn't go trick-or-treating unless they held the hands of their big brothers and sisters. So I had to be old enough to go trick-or-treating before my parents, because I was the eldest, would allow me to go trick-or-treating. And I went with friends, and it was a whole big deal. Who were you going to go trick-or-treating with was a whole situation. And among our peers, we decided this. This was a holiday we owned. Now, we knew to look out for razor blades. Of course, we were told these things years ago. Razor blades, and we were told, don't take apples. Only have wrapped candy. Okay, we got it. But it was really fun knocking on doors of people we didn't know. Everybody was walking distance to our neighborhood. We didn't get in the car and go anywhere because I lived in a community where the biggest lot was a quarter of an acre. So you could take, you know, you could do streets upon streets. Our trick-or-treat bags were pillowcases. We were very sophisticated and we were very greedy. We only took one unless the person said you can have more than one, and then we took more. And we always went for UNICEF. We always collected money for UNICEF with pennies, mostly pennies. Lots and lots of pennies collected for UNICEF. But it was our holiday. And I remember my mom saying, the only thing that she would say is, you have to go out before dark. So I would have to go trick-or-treating at 4:30 in the afternoon. Okay, I had an overprotective Jewish mother. What do you want? That's what I had. But I could come home at like 7 or 7:30 as it was dark-ish, but not that dark. And it was really fun. And we took our flashlights and we went as a neighborhood, like we would go with four or five kids. And so I have to tell you, my own prejudice is when I see parents take over for their kids' Halloween, when they hover so much that it becomes their holiday too, when they horn in on it by dressing up, there's just something a little bit about it to me that speaks of this unwillingness or this, maybe it's not, maybe that's not the right word. It speaks to me of this idea that so many grown-ups want to be perpetually kids themselves. Like they won't let kids be in that magical time of stepping out into the world of a little bit of independence, that scary, risky world of a little bit of independence. And that to me is what growing up is about. Giving your kids a little bit of leash, a little bit at a time. That scary, risky world of independence. So you say to your kids, okay, you're only going to go on this block and that block, and you're going to go for 2 hours, and I'm going to know that you're going to be coming home at X time, and we're going to have that conversation, but it's your deal. It's your fun. It's not my fun. 203-333-9422 if you want to talk and share your thoughts about Halloween and costumes on the Lisa Wexler Show. And it's 21 minutes after 11 o'clock, 203-333-9422. Adrienne Brodeur coming up. She wrote a controversial book, which we're going to talk about. It's got a very controversial subtitle to it, actually. But Christian, at 203-333-9422, we're talking a little bit about Halloween or trick-or-treating. And, well, let's go to the caller first, and then we'll go to you. Because I know Christian had a comment, but, you know, we've got the calls coming in. 203-333-9422. In the meantime, and we will get to the calls, I do want to say that I want to give a shout out to our own Senator Richard Blumenthal, because he has done more to protect our canines in action than just about any public official. Do you know that he has put in bill after bill to try and get our canines to be able to fly home safely after they've been in action, and that he only got it done in 2016. Before that, there was no appropriation. He's also tried to get vet bills for canines covered. Could you imagine a canine serving the federal government? You know, one of the heroes in the recent operation was the dog that helped in the operation against al-Baghdadi. We don't know if the dog was injured or not, but or traumatized or not, but could you imagine that we did not have appropriation for vet bills for these animals? That's insane. So a shout out to Senator Blumenthal, because he really is a friend to the canine animals, and he's trying to make sure that all their medical expenses are fully covered and that their owners can fly them home after they have devoted themselves in service so that they can retire in comfort, as they should. Let's go to Carla from Westport about Halloween. Hey, Carla.
How are you, Lisa?
Hi, sweetheart. I have full disclosure, Carla is one of my dearest friends. There could only be one Carla from Westport. Hi, sweetheart. Thank you for listening today, honey.
Listen, I was listening, and there is one thing you did not touch on about Halloween that really bothers me a lot.
Okay, tell me.
When I buy candies for children. But when their parents get online to get candy, Really, I find it offensive.
Oh, that's disgusting. Carla, has any parent ever come to your house for candy for themselves?
Yes.
Oh, no. God.
Yes, they
that's
come
gross.
With their children. Oh, and they get online to get candy.
I can't believe that.
Yes. I mean, it's like, even sometimes, you know, I'm involved with the town and we give candy out down the beach because there's lots of kids.
Yeah.
Even people out of town that come, and the children, of course, they're welcome, but their parents come with them because they're driving, you know, from
yes.
other towns. They have a costume, and they get in line to get candy.
I can't even handle that. That is really repulsive, actually. That
yeah.
is really repulsive. And that's part of the theme of the parents wanting to stay kids and not letting the kids be kids themselves.
Yeah. I
don't like when the parents are in costume. I got to be honest with you. I think it's not their place to be in costume. It's about the children.
I agree with you, but if they choose to have the costume to make the kids happy and be part of their holiday, do not come and get the candy.
Yeah, that's right. I'm with you. If you're going to get in costume, stay away from the candy.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. And, you know, you reminded me of something, Carla. Today in Westport is the kids' parade.
Yes.
So at 3:30 in Town Hall in Westport, I will be in Town Hall, and we've got so much candy. If you're listening and you're a little kid in a costume and you want some candy, come to room 100 in Town Hall around 3:30 today, probate court. We have the good candy. We have the Kit Kats and the Reese's. We have the good candy. Yeah.
And I love those, but I'm not going to come and take it from the kids.
No, definitely
I feel
like not.
I'm robbing them.
Definitely
you know?
Not. By the way, Carla, what kind of turnout do you get in your neighborhood nowadays? Do the kids still knock on the door?
Well, when I first moved here in 1991, there was a lot of kids. Then, you know, the kids go to college,
right.
The parents sell the home, and we had nobody.
Yeah.
I mean, it was
right.
like, it was unbelievable. Now, that it was another turnout, and we do have children. We don't have that many. Maybe I have about 20 of them.
Oh, 20 is good.
Yeah, and what I do is because my husband decides, you know, then we have 200.
Uh-huh.
I give them 3 or 4 pieces each.
Of course.
Because otherwise I end up eating
right.
them, and I don't want to.
Me too. Me too, Carla. I end up eating it too. All right, sweetheart. Thanks for the call, honey.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, 25 minutes after the hour, we're going to chat with Adrian Brodeur in a little bit. Christian, did you want to tell us a Halloween story? I never let you get to talk. I'm always busy having you field all the calls.
Well, it's not really a story, but when I was a kid, there was a house.
Which wasn't that long ago, for the record.
No.
Right.
But down the street, there were these people, and I don't know if they were never home or they didn't want to come to the door or what, but they had a basket out on the porch.
Oh, yes, we had
and
that,
it,
too.
And it was a sign, and it said, please help yourself to some candy, and it was always empty, the dish.
Oh.
So I don't know if they purposely put it out there.
No, maybe somebody got to it first, Christian, and took everything in it.
Well, that's the other thing.
That's the logical conclusion.
Who knows if they dumped a whole bucket into their little orange.
Otherwise, it would be a nasty Halloween prank, wouldn't it? Please help yourself with an empty. That could be a Halloween prank, though. Totally. Totally.
Does Shayna get dressed up?
You know, she may for the first time this year because my friend dropped off a costume for her.
Ah.
And also, for the first time this year, this is her first year. This is her first Halloween.
Yes, it is.
She's cute.
She's sleeping. Pink.
She is a cotton. I have to say, last night we went to Doggone Smart, plug for Doggone Smart. We went there for training because we're doing training every Monday night. And she's the only one who at over a year still has a housebreaking situation. We know that the breed lags. She's a Bichon. They take a little longer than others. But she's taking longer than the others take. And I'm not sure what I'm doing wrong. I know I'm supposed to confine her to space and all of that. Obviously, I'm not a consistent, good enough parent. But with everything else, she's perfectly on target. She sits. She goes down. She stays. She comes. She does all those wonderful commands. Except the housebreaking is pretty much on her own schedule. It is 1127-203-333-9422. After a bunch of conversation and some recent unfortunate deaths, New York City is going to add 250 miles of protected bike lanes in Manhattan. 25 cyclists were killed on city streets this year, the highest toll in two decades. But that's because we have City Bike and we have so many more people encouraged to use bicycles than we did years ago. So now the city has decided that their solution, Mayor Bill de Blasio and the City Council, have agreed on a $1.7 billion plan to sharply expand the number of protected bike lanes as part of a sweeping effort to transform the city. And of course, this is in keeping with what Mayor Bloomberg originally began as. Mayor Bloomberg, if he had his way, would have no cars whatsoever in the city. And a big part of his plan was to get more bikers on instead of cars. But, you know, it's very dangerous for both the bikers and the cars. And pedestrians already have to look both ways and around the back of their head to go safely. Under pressure from the city council, the city would be required to build 250 miles of protected bike lanes in the coming years, along with what the New York Times describes as a dizzying list of other street upgrades that they'll be required to do. And the bike lanes are a key part of what is so-called the Streets Master Plan, which is the bill expected to be passed this week that will redesign New York City streets. The plan could face many challenges. Bike lanes have often faced fierce opposition. But the bill calls for the Transportation Department to release a plan every 5 years to make the streets safer, including targets that they have to hit and more cameras. What do you think of that, of having more bike lanes in New York City? I'm going to tell you what I think. I think it could be potentially very dangerous. I think we really have to think about where we put these bike lanes. The idea of protected. So the Streets Master Plan not only calls for bike lanes, but it calls for protected bike lanes for the first 30 miles in the first year and 50 miles in each subsequent year. Protected bike lanes that are going to have a lot of cameras on them. You know my prediction about this, right? More work for the negligence lawyers. There'll be a lot more unfortunate collisions between bikes and cars, and there'll be a lot more work for personal injury attorneys. It's 11:30. You know, it's like one of my very dear friends used to say to me about gay marriage before it was legal. She said, "Lisa, let them legalize gay marriage. It's only more work for the matrimonial attorneys." She was one of them. She was so funny. She said, "If they get married, they'll get divorced." 203-333-9422. We'll be back.
Giving you all the information you need to become the smartest person in the room. The Lisa Wexler Show. WICC 600.
And welcome back to the show. Joining us now is Adrienne Brodeur. Her book is called Wild Game, My Mother, Her Lover, and Me. Now, is that a little bit provocative subtitle? It was published to almost universal acclaim. The New York Times Book Review calls it exquisite and harrowing. It has been called electrifying, and Adrienne has spent the last 20 years of her professional life in the literary world. One of her great accomplishments in discovering other voices and cultivating other talents, she began her own publishing career with founding a fiction magazine and with filmmaker Francis Ford Coppola. She was editor-in-chief of that magazine for 6 years. That magazine, which was called Zoetrope All Story, won the prestigious National Magazine Award for Best Fiction 4 times. And she left publishing in 2013 to become the creative director and later executive director of a literary arts nonprofit called Aspen Words. And in 2017, Adrienne launched the Aspen Words Literary Prize, which is a $35,000 annual award for an influential work of fiction that illuminates a vital contemporary issue. She splits her time between Cambridge and Cape Cod, one of my favorite places on the planet. Adrienne Brodeur is going to be in our community at the New Canaan Library talking with Allison Camerata on October 29th at 7 p.m. Is that tonight? Are we October 29th already? That's tonight at 7. And she'll be at RJ Julia, our favorite bookstore, on October 30th talking with Danny Shapiro, another incredibly talented author. Adrienne, hi, and welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me, Lisa. That was a lovely introduction.
Well, you're very, very welcome. You certainly deserve it. So I would like to hear, I want to hear about Wild Game. I know it's your memoir, but a little bit about your life before then. It sounds to me like you've always had this passion for great writing. So my question, Adrian, is for you, how do you define, if I were to say to you, well, you know, how do you know good writing when you see it? How do you know it?
Such a great question. And the truth is, I actually wasn't one of those kids with a flashlight under the covers reading. My stepmother, who owned a beautiful independent bookstore in California, actually started pressing novels and memoirs and poetry collections into my hands as a 20-something-year-old, and she ignited this passion in me, and I just became one of the most avid readers ever. And I actually love all sorts of literary material, so I do not shy away from the occasional thriller and so on, but I do, my love in what the world that I've worked most in is literary fiction and memoir. And, you know, it's a little like that famous saying about pornography, you know it when you read it. Mm-hmm. You know it when you see it, and you know it when you read it. When the language is as beautiful as the storytelling and there's this confluence, I think that's when you know you're onto something.
You know, the memoir is my favorite subgenre also. It really is my favorite. I love it so much. And I confess that I have Wild Game on my nightstand, but I haven't had a chance to read it yet, which means I'll probably want to interview again, Adrian, after I've read the book. So now I'm going to give you a chance to talk to me about your life. You know, full disclosure, I haven't read your book yet. Normally, I've had a chance to read every book of every person I interview, but yours is literally sitting there. I finally made my way through Sheila Weller's Carrie Fisher, which was a lot, by the way, but it's wonderful. It's a wonderful book.
Well, no worries about not having read it, and I would love to come back on your show. The book essentially is the story of my very complicated relationship with my mother, whose name is Malabar, and it starts with this incredibly pivotal moment of my life, probably the most pivotal moment I've had in my life, which came when I was 14. So the year was 1980. The setting was Cape Cod, also one of my favorite places on earth, at our summer home. And well after midnight, my door to my bedroom creaked open, and my mother came in and sat on the bed beside me and basically woke me up by whispering, "Ben Souther just kissed me." And Ben Souther was my stepfather's best friend. And what I didn't know at this moment was that it was the beginning of what would become an epic love affair between my mother Malabar and her husband's best friend, Ben Souther. But what I did realize, like even in real time, as my mother, you know, woke me up to tell me this was one of those moments, one that has a before and an after. And I had gone to bed in the land of childhood as my mother's daughter, 14 years old, and I awoke and fully immersed in the grown-up world, and I was my mother's best friend and confidant.
Wow. Adrian Brodeur, that's a very, very big wow. And well, what were you like as a 14-year-old, Adrian? Were you somebody with the maturity that your mother could look to, or were you a wild child yourself? Why do you think, did she turn to you out of desperation or out of this love and feeling for you that you could become very close friends? Was she just being incredibly immature and selfish and confiding in you? Well, I mean, talk to me.
That's a very big question.
All these thoughts came in my head at the same time.
Yeah. Question, right?
Right.
I would say I was a typical 14-year-old girl in as much as I wasn't a wild child, I was your normal teenager. And what I think is, like most children, I craved my mother's love and attention. My parents were divorced. There was a lot of distractions. And I also wanted her to be happy. And my mother had never been a particularly happy woman. She was very glamorous and charismatic, but I think she'd always been quite lonely. And I think this moment, I mean, I cannot really, you know, do more than hazard a guess as to why she woke me up, but I think it was a combination of loneliness, suddenly, you know, falling in love, seeing this new opportunity for herself and her life, and I was sort of the only person in the house that she could wake up, and there was probably had been much to drink that night.
So were you the only child?
No, I had an older brother as well, but I think in that way that the mother-daughter bond tends to be, you know, a little chattier.
Yeah. What kind of name is Malabar?
Malabar is an unusual name. She was born in India, in Bombay, on Malabar Hill.
Oh.
And, you know, I have often wondered if my mother would be the great force of nature that she was had she been called Betty or Sue or
Anne. She was given an unusual name from birth, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. And no one, well, her father shortened it to Mabby, but in my lifetime, I never heard anyone call my mother anything but Malabar.
Yeah, well, it's such an amazing name, actually, but it sounds like Zanzibar or something exotic and fabulous, right? Doesn't it?
Just like the lady.
Yeah. That's like, is she still alive, your mom?
She is still alive.
So what did she think of the book?
You know, I'm incredibly grateful that we have this very intense bond. And about 4 or 5 years ago, when I told her that I really was going to need to write about it, that she was open to that and gave me her blessing and understood that need. Unfortunately, since that time, she has become gravely ill, so it's really not something that we even discuss anymore.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
So you wrote about this time, you're 14, your parents are already divorced, so it's not like your mother was having an illicit affair with your father's best friend.
That's correct. My parents divorced when I was about 4. My father remarried and got another divorce. My mother was finally able to marry my first stepfather, and just before that marriage, I mean, really days or weeks before, he had 4 strokes in 5 days, and they went on and got married, but he had never been the same person again. He was, he really became an old man overnight. And so about 8 years into that marriage is when this love affair started with his son.
Ah, so your mother was married, but she wasn't married to your father.
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Oh, that's already complicated. Okay.
So both of these and this other couple who also had a sick spouse, they were couple friends. So they knew each other, and it was an affair that was sort of carried out in plain view on some level.
Mm. And did the affair result in the breakup of this second marriage to this ill man?
No, they, you know, the story that they told themselves and that they told me was that they didn't mean to fall in love. They didn't want to hurt these people who they were married to, who they cared deeply about. So they were not going to end their marriages. They were just going to wait and hope.
And what were they waiting and hoping for?
That there would be a time that they could be together.
Oh, and was there ever that time, Adrian?
This is such a spoiler.
Oh, you don't want to say? You don't have to say. But but you know, I read memoirs not really for the plot. The plot is interesting.
No, I agree.
I read memoirs for the language. Yes.
My mother and her lover did end up getting married after both their spouses died in 1992, I believe.
Wow.
Yep.
And so tell me a little bit. So you wrote this book called Wild Game. And of course, your choice of language is very intentional. And what was the game?
Well, so Wild Game has a double entendre. My mother happens to have been just an astonishing and spectacular cook. She studied at Le Cordon Bleu. She worked in the test kitchen of Time and Life. And she went on to write cookbooks for my entire life. She had a food column for the Boston Globe.
Wow.
And her lover, Ben Souther, in the book, was an avid recreational hunter and fisherman. So they decided as a ruse to cover for the affair as well as to create more time for these couples to spend together to create a Wild Game cookbook together.
Ah, okay. So, interesting.
Yep.
Okay.
The plot thickens.
The plot thickens, like the soup. Right.
Mm.
And, okay, but that must have been so much fun to be the daughter of a cookbook author. Oh, my goodness. How fabulous is that? Anytime you brought your friends over, the kitchen probably smelled fantastic.
Absolutely. It was, you know, but also, of course, when you imagine being a, you know, fourth and fifth grader, you know, you're hoping for something other than sweetbreads for dinner. I really longed for a McDonald's hamburger, which I don't think I tried for till I was around 20.
Was it always fancy food? It wasn't roast chicken?
It was, I mean, my mother made a wonderful roast chicken, but mostly it was kind of elaborate and rich French foods. My mother loved butter, loved sauces. She really prepared just wonderful food.
And did anybody have a weight problem, Adrian? We're chatting with Adrian Brodeur, who's going to be tonight at the New Canaan Library and later this week at RJ Julia.
Shockingly, no.
No.
You know, good metabolism, but also she allowed no nibbling. So there was no snacking on chips and so on. It was just these fabulous meals, and then you wouldn't eat until the next one.
Wow. That's, you know, that's very European. That's very healthy. Yeah. I guess. Are you a cook, too?
I am a cook. I'm not a cook of my mother's caliber, but it's, in fact, one of the things that I absolutely love and find so satisfying. I know a lot of women and men, too, parents especially, find it, you know, a real chore. And many household things I do find a chore, but cooking, I find it therapeutic, chopping up those onions at the end of a stressful day. And I love putting out a healthy meal for my family and just making something. And we really try to sit around the table together.
Are you're a mom now yourself?
I have two children, yes. And my daughter happens to be, at this moment, 14 years old, exactly the age I was when my mother woke me up. So it's been a real eye-opener and moment of revelation to actually see what a child she is and what a child I must have been, and really how corrosive having to keep this kind of secret was for me.
How long was it that this confidential relationship between you and your mother went on?
Over a decade.
But the fact is,
it has a much longer reach than that, of course, because it was a very formative part of my life that, and also there was a legacy in my family. I mean, her father had a secret other family, her mother had affairs. So there was this real legacy of deceptions and secrets that I was very determined to put an end to with my own children and having the next generation.
Was your mother confiding in you about her sex life too, Adrian?
No, not in any kind of lurid details, but I participated. I mean, I was someone who in a way I enabled it to happen because, of course, these couple friends would get together and my role was to suggest we take a walk. And, of course, the two ill ones would demur. And I was really sort of, I made a lot of it happen or possible because, of course, what could look more interesting or more innocent, I mean, than a 14-year-old chaperone?
Did you feel used?
You know, at the time, no. I mean, at my age now, looking back, I really see how damaging it was. At the time, of course, it was kind of thrilling.
Yes,
it was like being in this mother-daughter version of Thelma and Louise.
Right.
I was the girl behind the wheel of the getaway car, just sort of waiting for her to come running and say, oh, help me, do this. What do we do? How do you, you know, and I took care of my stepfather when she was off meeting her lover. And, it was heady, but corrupting. I mean, deeply corrupting when you think about it.
Oh, yeah. Deeply corrupting. And that's why I asked if you felt used.
Yeah.
Because, you know, my mom talks about this story once. It was a long time ago, Adrian, and it was the only time this ever happened. But she had a friend. My mother got very sick, and she was in the hospital. And she had a couple friend. And my mother really didn't know anything that was going on, except when she was in the hospital very ill, her friend came with a different man than her husband.
Wow.
And then what happened in that same visit was this woman's husband came. And so while introducing them to each other, my mother got the picture pretty quickly that her friend was having an affair with this guy. And was pled with to cover up for it. And she was sick. She was in the hospital. So she said something like, well, this is a friend. Something very nondescript like that.
Mm-hmm.
And after she got out of the hospital, she was still very ill for a long time. The husband came storming to the house. And he wanted to beat up my mother. Because he found out that he thought that my mother was an accomplice to this affair, which ultimately broke up that marriage.
Right.
And my mother has spoken about this for years, this feeling of having been used.
There's the feeling of being used, which is very real. And then there's also, you know, because I was so young and you know, obviously more loyal to my mother than probably your mother was to a friend. I mean, it was a primary relationship.
Absolutely,
in my life.
Of course.
But I think the hardest part about keeping secrets of that magnitude is it keeps you genuinely from being authentically known or connecting to people, because there's this whole side of you mm-hmm. that your friends or your boyfriend doesn't and can't know about
can't
it.
Can't know
I think,
about that.
You know,
yep.
Carl Jung was the one who called secrets psychic poison, and to me, that's the perfect
yeah.
description.
I think that's right. I think the secrets,
yeah.
they do. They corrode us, and they're so plentiful in life, right? But if they're your secret, that's one thing. If you're choosing to keep a secret that's your secret, that's one thing. But when
right,
you're being...
it's a burden to put it on someone
exactly.
else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, Adrienne Brodeur, it's a pleasure to speak with you. Now, of course, I want to read the book Wild Game even more than ever. It's on my nightstand. I promise to get to it. I'll probably invite you back. But in the meantime, enjoy the New Canaan Library tonight. Have a good time with Allison. And RJ Julia, what could be better? And say hi to Danny Shapiro for me. She's a fabulous writer herself. She's amazing.
I agree. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Adrienne Brodeur, on the Lisa Wexler Show. We'll be right back.
Waking up your cerebral cortex. The Lisa Wexler Show. WICC 600.
And in some news stories you may have missed, in the Jennifer Doulos case, it looks like Fotis Doulos and... what's her name? Oh, I'm having a brain freeze. The mistress, Michelle Traconis. They have broken up because Michelle Traconis has taken her things and moved out of the... She's moved out of the home in Farmington where she was living. And in the meantime, the gag order motion is making its way up. Norm Pattis filed a 40-page brief yesterday. And in that brief, he makes the argument that the gag order is too broad and it ought to be lifted. In other stories, so much else to talk about. Here's a little tidbit for you. If you have psoriasis, it's associated with an increased risk of cancer, according to a new review of studies. The Journal of American Medical Association, JAMA Dermatology, combined data from 58 studies and found that overall, compared with people without the condition, psoriasis of any degree of severity was associated with an 18% increased risk of cancer, severe psoriasis with a 22% increase. Cancer mortality was elevated in all cases of severe psoriasis. And for some specific kinds of cancer, the risk was even higher. For example, if you have severe psoriasis, I can't say that 10 times without stopping. I'm doing the best I can. Was associated with more than 11 times the risk for squamous cell carcinoma. That's the most benign kind of skin cancer, which I know is an oxymoron, but you know what I mean. But also associated with double the risk for esophageal and liver cancer. And get this, a 45% increased risk for pancreatic cancer if you have severe psoriasis. And any degree of psoriasis, severe or not, was significantly associated with colorectal cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, cancers of the kidney and pancreas. The reason for the connection is unclear, but there was a known link between chronic inflammation and cancer. And apparently psoriasis has to do with chronic inflammation. So just to let you know, try and work on that psoriasis if you can. It can be so painful and so uncomfortable. 203-333-9422. 203-333-9422. And other stories, the rivalry between the United States and China is spreading to the financial ties. And this is a really important conversation, but it seems that we have something in America called the Thrift Savings Plan, which is a gigantic retirement savings vehicle for all federal government employees, which includes White House officials and lawmakers, members of the military. I mean, the fund must, I don't know, it must be worth maybe approaching $1 trillion. It's got to be worth in the many billions. Anyway, starting next year, the Thrift Fund was supposed to change its mix of investments to increase its exposure to China. In other words, it was supposed to be on track to investing in more Chinese companies. But some in the Trump administration are trying to stop that because they say that this will pump federal worker savings into companies that could undermine American national security. And I agree with them. Last week, a bipartisan group of senators sent a letter to the plan's governing board urging it to reverse its decision. Yesterday, Senator Marco Rubio, a Florida Republican, said he would introduce bipartisan legislation to block the decision. What they're trying to do is create a recognition that by continuing to put our dollars in China, we are just making China stronger. And we have to stop ourselves and ask ourselves, do we really want to keep doing that? Do we really want to keep making China stronger? And that begins with putting our money where our mouth is. So I think it's a good thing that the Trump administration and Senator Rubio and the bipartisan effort are taking a second look at divesting so much, at investing and divesting so much of our money into Chinese companies, because the Chinese companies, by and large, are agents of the Chinese government. And by and large, as we've seen in Hong Kong and what they've done with the Uyghurs and the Muslim population, they represent a dramatically different set of values from us. So why should we keep making them richer? What are we doing? We should stop. 203-333-9422. It's a couple of minutes before noon. One other quick note from you. This, of course, buried on page A16, where all the good news is. This is not good news. This is just news, and it probably warrants a longer conversation, so maybe we should continue it tomorrow. But the bottom line is that many Democratic contenders, and particularly Bernie Sanders, but also Pete Buttigieg and others, have aligned themselves with a very progressive left stance on Israel. And for the very first time, they are saying they are open to withholding aid from Israel if Israel decides to annex more land in the West Bank. There was a conference, a J Street conference. The J Street is a lobbying group that represents a pro-left, a group of Jews. And speakers at the conference repeatedly referred to what they call racist policies in the United States and Israel, with Bernie Sanders getting a big standing ovation. So there we are, and there are the roots of a lot of distrust among the Jewish community for the Democratic Party. I'm Lisa Wexler. We'll be back tomorrow. And Paul Pacelli is up at 2.